I got this little bulldog mix, what can whip any dog alive. Sinks his teeth into the nose of whatever he's fighting. Whatever it is, tastes blood, gets still, then starts backing up with Red Eye still hooked in. Then it might try to shake him off, but Red Eye's too heavy, and so sometimes it just gives up and stands there froze until I can get over there and turn Red Eye's flappy lip up under his back teeth and mash down hard until he turns loose. Then whatever it is runs away whimpering. I have seen Red Eye chew up and swallow whatever piece of nose might got stuck in his teeth. Used to I'd say hold fast for him to hang on and halt for him to turn loose, but he's unlearned the halt part and got a hold fast stuck in his head somehow. I ain't worked with him much in the last 2 years or so.
Novelist Clyde Edgerton. He's here with readings and conversation about his new book, Red Eye, the story of an itinerant undertaker, science and archaeology in late 19th century Colorado, religion, and a mean little dog named Red Eye. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Clyde Edgerton's novels and stories are well-known portraits of the modern South, especially his native North Carolina. In his new book, however, Clyde Edgerton departs from the Tar Heel State for points westward. Set in late 19th century Colorado, the new book is called Red Eye, a novel combining history, religion, and the beginnings of American archaeology. With a reading from Red Eye, here's Clyde Edgerton.
The first move, said Mr. Blankenship, the first move is to get a dead man to explode. It's already happened in Arizona. One exploded down there. That's Arizona, says Mr. Copeland. It ain't happened around here. Well, it will now, if you're serious about all this. And if we've come this far, then we ought to do it upright, I say. Do it right, Pard, at the train station. Then Mr. Blankenship says that when somebody's husband dies, they can say something like, "Now, Ms. Brown, we can certainly preserve Mr. Brown the tried and true way, on ice. There's no problem there, as far as it goes. But there is one potential drawback. There is one thing that can happen on the funeral day if the weather is real hot and you got a real fine airtight coffin like P.J. Copeland builds."
Clyde, my friend, welcome back to the National Humanities Center. Congratulations on Red Eye.
Thanks, Wayne.
Who is this dog? Who is this title character you have written about here?
Well, he came to be a mean little fictional dog. The idea started while I was writing the book. Somebody told me about a dog they'd just heard about, a little dog that would hook into the nose of any other dog he was around. And that sounded interesting to me, so that got me started creating this little character.
Now, how do you move out of North Carolina in this book, Clyde, and you take us all the way out to Colorado, and you take us back in time, farther back than you have taken any of your fiction before? That's quite a leap for you and a big challenge, something new for you as a writer.
Yeah, I think usually when I start a book, I'm looking for something new, whether it's in technique, point of view, or whether it's in setting or characters or character. And with this particular book, I started writing a book more like my others, I suppose, about a freelance embalmer, which grew out of a conversation I had overheard, and I wrote about this character and his family, made up of family, but I was stumped with where to go with this book when I traveled west and saw Mesa Verde.
Uh-huh.
I just happened, a friend of mine said, "You need to take your daughter out there." And so my daughter, who was 10 at the time, I took her to see it, and we both went bananas. When I saw these cliff dwellings, I just was in a sense overcome, to the extent that I bought the biography of one of the first white men who went in there, mm-hmm, in the late 1800s.
This is Benjamin, what's his
Benjamin
name?
Benjamin Wetherill.
Right.
And his biography, his life story, was so dramatic. And my interest in these cliff dwellings was so strong that I knew I needed to write about this, and the best way to do it would be to make up a character not unlike this fictional archaeologist, this fellow who himself became so obsessed that he lost his ranch and eventually lost his life. He was so obsessed with this history in these cliffs of the Native Americans who'd lived there.
Tell me, give our listeners, Clyde Edgerton, a quick overview of what happens in Red Eye. You bring together so many remarkable circumstances. As you said, a freelance embalmer. You got one of the world's first sort of theme park archaeologists at work here. You have a young woman. You have a man from England. You've got a sort of hired gun mercenary. My goodness, it's tough to summarize, but...
I've not tried to summarize. I've not even thought about summarizing it. So what I think would be better is for me to sort of say how the book came about. And in the process, I think you'll get an idea of how it happened. I started, as I said, with this freelance embalmer. Realized because I was interested in the cliff dwellings and interested in, suddenly, in an amateurish way, archaeology, I had to move back to the late 1800s in southwest Colorado. So I made me a little town out there and put me an amateur archaeologist and my freelance embalmer.
All right, now this is Mumford Rock.
Mumford Rock, Colorado is the fictional town. Then I wanted some connections to North Carolina because of my... ability to write the language I grew up with. So I made PJ, the freelance embalmer, be the uncle of a young woman named Star Copeland.
These are the Copelands, right?
Right, still from another book. And she's traveling west, and I thought it would be interesting because of my recent exposure and fascination with the West, for her to mimic or to have the same experience that I did in some ways, that would be interesting to write about, for me to try to capture that fascination, with the geography.
Uh-huh.
Fascination with the geography. So I had her headed out that way, and I needed a little humor, and since I'd been reading a bit about embalming and the funeral industry because I was dealing with this character, I had discovered that the first school of embalming in the United States was in Denver in 1870, which was perfect. So I said, I'll have him have been there. And so I wanted, and also had come across an episode of some corpses exploding in airtight coffins. And I thought I might be able, if I did it right, get some humor out of that. I could also not get humor. So I started throwing in characters. I threw in a fellow who I thought would be a businessman and trying to get a funeral industry started in the Southwest, hooked him up, and just kind of then in the meantime, I had read about the Mountain Meadows Massacre.
Let's pause on that, Clyde. This is an episode in Western, or properly speaking, I guess you'd call it Mormon, LDS history, that figures in your book. Talk to us about that for a moment.
Well, I came across a book. I was reading a little cowboy book, and the author, whose name I believe was Ivan Denton, gave a overview of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. I had seen the term Mountain Meadows Massacre several times in my reading. I'd become obsessed with reading about the West, but I didn't know what it was. And he gave a short overview and included part of the confession of John Doyle Lee, the person who was eventually convicted of participating in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And Lee had described his feelings in this involvement of massacring some so-called Gentiles from Arkansas.
Now, this was a group of, in effect, vigilantes who had been sent down into southern Utah by Brigham Young, and they attacked a wagon train, am I right? But they dressed the whole thing up in terms of an Indian attack.
Well, so it's not clear if Brigham Young... factually, there is circumstantial evidence that says he was directly involved, but that's never been established as far as I know. Briefly, let me try to tell you what was happening in the late 1850s in Utah. The United States government had just sent 2,500 troops to replace Brigham Young as governor, not as the religious leader, but as governor. The Mormons became very upset about this and decided that, in effect, war had been declared against them. So they prepared for war. Militia, arms, and they were close with the Indians and knew that they would need the help of the Indians in case of war. This is 1856. Well, by 1857, they're really hot
and preaching sermons of blood atonement and so forth. And a wagon train from Arkansas happens to come down the length of Utah. The Mormons have decided that if any wagon train comes from the United States, they will not give any aid, any supplies, any water, any bread, anything. So tension develops between the Mormons and this wagon train of people from Arkansas. The wagon train camps on the eastern edge of the Nevada desert in Utah, a place called Mountain Meadows, for a week. The plan is to rest for a week. And for the first time, they let down their defenses. They don't draw their wagons up in a circle. For the first time, they had been drawing the wagons up for protection against the Mormons through down through Utah.
And then here things take an ugly turn.
What happens is the Mormons apparently told a large group of Indians to take out the wagon train, in effect. The Indians attacked on a Monday morning and killed several of the Gentiles, as they were called by the Mormons. But the Gentiles, the immigrants, put up a much stronger fight than expected, and after 3 days, the Indians had been unable to break through to wipe them out. So they went back to Cedar City, 35 miles away, and told the Mormon leaders there that they weren't able to wipe out the wagon train, at which point the Mormon leaders and 50 Mormon men came to the site, got the Indians to withdraw and hide along the trail back to Cedar City. Two or three Mormons with white flags approached the besieged immigrants and said to them, the Indians had withdrawn, we will take you back to Cedar City safely if you'll put your wounded and weapons in wagons to be followed by women and children and then the men.
And then the whole wagon train was in effect wiped out. Have we got this right?
Right, they started leading them back to Cedar City. And at a certain point, the Mormons said, halt, do your duty. Mm-hmm. 50 Mormon men shot about 50 immigrants' men and sat down, and the Indians came from the bushes and killed the women and children and the men who were left, dead, with the exception of 17 children. They decided to not kill the children who were not old enough to talk,
All right, now here is where your book, Red Eye, Clyde Edgerton, takes a very definite turn toward the serious, toward the historical. We should remind our listeners that this is, after all, a novel, that this is great fun to read. It is full of wonderful, good, great humor. Nonetheless, what you are doing is crystallizing in your imagination an experience in Western history in order to write about some large words like toleration. Who it is that we should follow? Whose orders are we going to take? How do people decide what it is that's going to drive their lives? We're on the right track with this?
Exactly. I realized, and what happened, incidentally, at the end, is that the Mormons decided that they would never tell the truth about what happened. They would always say that the Gentiles were wiped out by Indians and that they had saved the 17 children.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, 20 years later, one Mormon was brought to trial and executed. The woman who wrote the book about it is a Mormon woman, Juanita Brooks. She spent her life researching this massacre.
Mm-hmm.
It's a marvelous book, and there has been much written about it. But when I first read about it, I became, in a way, obsessed with the history of this massacre, what had happened. It seemed to me to be the epitome of a destructive use of power, which is believed to be coming from God.
Well, not
this phone line to God business was so powerful that this incredibly tricky, devious, awful murdering of women and children happened, and the Mormon men involved, their reason for allowing the Indians to kill the women and children was that they did not want to chance the shedding of innocent blood themselves. So I went into this thing with a great deal of bitterness. That's not how I came out of it, fortunately, because during the writing of it, I gained some insights into myself, to my own religious upbringing, mm-hmm. and to the intolerance of human beings toward other human beings.
Oh,
in
I don't
general.
Think I don't think anybody's got a complete purchase on on the unfortunate practice of intolerance. You use a character in your book, Clyde, a man named Cobb Pittman. You create a fictional person who is carrying around with him the guilt, the burden of if not Mountain Meadows exactly itself, then that kind of incident. And you use it, I know that you novelists are reluctant to admit that you're preaching a line, but after all, you are making a case here for what, the softer, gentler side of our human nature rather than that which is filled with vengeance and bloodshed and hatred.
Well, I think that would be fair to say if someone were looking for that. I hope that is there in any of my novels. But I did have an opportunity to, and this is a way I think writers are lucky, fiction writers especially, I had a way to channel my strong feeling about what had happened into a particular character and have him speak for that part of me mm-hmm. which was disgusted with what had happened.
Now, again, this is Cobb Pittman. This is the guy who owns your title character, Red Eye.
Cobb is a bounty hunter of sorts, and he's after someone who was involved in the Mountain Meadows Massacre, mm-hmm. and he has this little dog.
Now, this would be Bishop Thorpe and his team of, quote, ex-wives, unquote. You have a lot of fun with Western and Mormon history there, do you not?
Well, Bishop, this book, the timing of the historical time of this book is about the time that the Mormon Church came to say, or the leaders, or the leader, Woodruff, I believe, at that time, came to say that he had had a vision which said, in fact, that polygamy was not right.
All right, and the historians will tell us that this was the price of statehood, in
yes,
effect.
That was the last hurdle. And again, back in the 50s, that this almost a state of war mm-hmm. between the constitutional government and religious government in Utah, the constitutional government being in the United States, or at least the perception of it.
Sure.
And of course, from the Mormon perspective, they had been run out of many places. They had been their leader had been assassinated, and that history was what they were coming out of.
Mm-hmm. These are a people who know something about persecution and intolerance, as a matter of fact. Would you say, to cut to the chase here, Clyde, would you say that this book is, suppose I accused you of writing an anti-religious or anti-Mormon book, what would you say to me?
I would say that the book initially, in my mind, was to be in part, I mean, since it was many things are happening and going on and I'm trying to do all kinds of things with relationships between characters. I did have to keep telling myself with this book because the book was coming from a place, that is, from geography, from a place that I had become enchanted with, that is, the West, the Southwest, because it was coming from that place, and because it was coming from some history, pieces of history that I was finding myself very much interested in. Rather than writing a travel guide or a piece of history, I had to keep telling myself that you need to be writing about relationships between characters. So I had several kinds of relationships: father, son, mother, son,
man to many wives.
Yes, man, man to wife.
Right.
And I had all this going on. So, but my initial reaction to my reading of the Mountain Meadows Massacre was such that, if you had asked me when I started writing this book, is this an anti-Mormon book, I would have said, you better believe it is an uh-huh. anti-Mormon book. The experience of writing it, by the time I finished the book, I would say that it's yes and no, it's an anti-Mormon book. It's an anti-whatever causes us to behave with evil intentions toward one another. It's against that, I hope, in some indirect and direct way. But I also, in the process of writing the book, realized my own, the potential in myself. Were I 18 years old or 16 years old, the people who were leaders of my church when I was that old, had they said to me,
go off and kill somebody,
there is a bunch of people coming through our community
mm-hmm.
who are evil. This is what they've done. This is what they believe. This is what we've been told by God to do to them.
Mm-hmm.
Where would I have been? Would I have said, I'm sorry, I have to go to the beach, or I'm sorry, I have to read a book? No, I would have been there. I would have been there with them. I would have been there full of fury and anger, and I would have been there because of my belief that as a Christian, as a Southern Baptist, being told to do so by my elders, that I was right, and this was very honorable and very good. During the process of writing and reading, I came to realize that whatever the old saying is, but for the grace of God, therefore go I.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time the book was over, I had also gone back into the book and studied my characterization of Mormons, particularly, for example, the two wives, how I treated those, the cowboy, Zach Paulson, who
right.
ended up being a Mormon. He wasn't on the first draft, but he was later.
He's kind of a looser Mormon.
Yeah, he's relatively loose. And also the son, Hiram.
Uh-huh.
So I think there is empathy in the book for people who are Mormons. And if it were an anti-Mormon book, I believe there would be no empathy for people who are Mormons.
Clyde, again, your book is Red Eye, a Western. Let's talk about some of the lighter side, shall we say, of Red Eye, all this serious history and Mormonism and Blood Atonement and the Mountain Meadows Massacre. You've also got a mute grandma. You've got what the blurb calls the true father of the American tourist trap. You've got a philosopher Indian. How do you create these wonderful characters? How did all of this work in your imagination? Pick one of those for us.
Well, I think I end up having a need for something in the story, and I can feel only a need for, sometimes it's not even clear what I need. For example, let's take either one of those. The
mute grandma?
Okay, the mute grandma. When I had the family, before I had the family move out west, I knew I had a mother, a father, a baby and a 13-year-old boy, and I knew they were going to be in a home, and I knew they were going to be in a home where there was an embalming service. I knew that, and I knew to get something out of that, I needed a little larger family.
Mm-hmm.
So my first invention was an older sister, because I knew she'd be having dates over and having to explain what's going on in the kitchen, and I knew there'd be a source of humor. I'm not thinking Mountain Meadows Massacre or any message, and I'm thinking about what will be fun for me to sit down and write about.
Right.
Well, in addition to the once I got the two younger kids, the older sister, the mom, I knew I needed an older person there, and so I decided on a grandma. And it just the way I visualized the grandma was that she was in a wheelchair and she couldn't talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was realizing that at the same time I wanted her to end up in the kitchen, locked in the kitchen. When the kids were there alone, believing that there was a corpse in the kitchen, and since she couldn't talk, she would have to bump the door to try to get out, and they would frighten. In other words, I needed something for a scene. It sounds almost derogatory to say I needed a prop, and therefore I invented a person, but that's not unlike what it is.
Well, here, I mean, this is wonderful. You've got the grotesque elements of Flannery O'Connor and William Faulkner and all of your Southern literary ancestors, and you've taken them on a train ride out west, and the whole thing works. Congratulations.
Thanks. Thanks. Well, I appreciate that, and it was fun and hard to do. I had to generate a base of knowledge from reading, which is not what I've had to do in the past to write novels. I've usually written out of my experience.
Clyde Edgerton, again, your novel is Red Eye. To rehearse what you've done in this book, again, you've got Mormonism, you've got embalmers, you've got anthropologists, you have mute grandmas, you have tourist traps, so many wonderful things at work. What do you want your readers to think about when they come away from Red Eye?
Well, I think that I recognize that different readers will think in different ways after they experience the book. I can talk a little bit about how the writing of it affected me and hope that the reading of it will affect readers in the same way. I became interested in another location in the United States.
You sure did. You took a long trip.
In a way that I would like for readers to feel and maybe think about. Also, I do talk about good and evil. I write about good and evil, and I think in any time and in any person, those are subjects that are okay to think about, because the result of such thinking might be fruitful in a life. Although, as you know, and as we've talked about, I'm trying not to write messages. I would hope that they would be pleased with living in a place and at a time that is different from their own for a few hours. And I would hope that they think, wow, I left this world and entered another world for a little while, and now I'm back in my own world. And if they can think that, then I think I will have been, to a point, successful.
That's a wonderful account of the way your imagination, the way the writerly imagination works. It's interesting and it's enjoyable to hear a writer be as explicit as that in talking about how you move yourself in space and time, and how you invite your readers to go with you.
Well, what led me to be a fiction writer was reading fiction and experiencing a movement of my body and soul to a different place and time, and then move back. It was magic to me when I read good fiction that was not distracting in any way other than to put me in a place. So that's what I want to do. That's what I wanted to do in writing my own fiction, make it possible for someone to move into a different place and back.
Clyde Edgerton is the author of Red Eye, a new novel available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. His other novels include Rainy and In Memory of Junior. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was novelist Clyde Edgerton. For a cassette tape of this program, please send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 762. That's program number 762. The address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, our zip code 27709. Next week, a conversation about realism in American culture and politics. My guest will be the president of Furman University, historian David Shy. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. From Southern writer Clyde Edgerton, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Clyde Edgerton will be here with readings and conversation about Red Eye, his new book about an itinerant undertaker, archaeology during late 19th century Colorado, religion, and a mean little dog named Red Eye. Clyde Edgerton's previous books portray his native North Carolina, but in Red Eye, he departs for points westward, and the trip is well worth taking. New fiction from novelist Clyde Edgerton, this week on Soundings.